Welcome to Shoot Me Straight, Dave Fields, Eddie Gallagher. Today we have a buddy of mine, Chandler Williams. He owns a local store here. He's owned a bunch of stuff, actually. A
couple things.
Yeah, he's entrepreneur, photographer, adventure, travel seeking, thrill seeker.
All of the above, yeah.
Were you born in Grayton?
No, I was born in Orlando, but I've lived, grew up in Freeport. So back, back in the fundamental days of Freeport, I guess.
Yeah.
fundamental days. It's blown up now.
Yeah.
What was Freeport like back then?
I don't think it's changed in a lot of ways other than the growth, but, you know, we had, very few. I think me and one of my other buddies, the only people that surfed and skated in the school, and it's very, plenty of redneck, love to go around in high school, but, Yeah, I mean, it's small, but it was, I think, innocently like a, it's a small town kind of vibe, so.
Yeah. Did you ever move away from here and then move back?
I did, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
When'd you move and where?
So my sophomore year in high school, I had gone to visit my sister going into my sophomore year, and I played basketball competitively. So I had bought a ticket to go to a basketball camp in Los Alamos. And then met the coach and said if I had a place out there, if I moved out there. So my sophomore year in high school, I bought a Greyhound ticket and, found myself in Los Alamos, New Mexico.
Wow.
Yeah.
Just booked it.
Yeah.
Parents didn't care?
I don't know if they cared or not. I mean, it's kind of, I've kind of been independent for a while in my life. So,
how old were you at that time?
I just turned 16.
16. Okay.
Yeah.
That'd be a big change going from Freeport, Florida.
Mexico. I was kind of just. I think I was just done with Freeport, at a young age. So, went out and lived out there.
You had a desire to travel, right? You enjoy traveling.
Yeah. Always been really comfortable traveling.
Yeah.
So,
what other places have you been?
Living wise, or
just travel to? You've been.
I've been all over the U.S., Hawaii a lot. I just counted the other day. I think I'm like 18 or 19 times to Costa Rica. So I've spent a lot of time shooting and surfing and traveling down there, Nicaragua. Australia, New Zealand. I just got back from Africa. I was in Iceland earlier in the year.
Wow.
So, oh, nice.
Yeah.
Dude, that's a place we want to go is Iceland.
Yeah, so ideally I'll start teaching workshops when it comes out to photography. So that's kind of the growth. But so Africa just recently got back, and that was a pretty amazing trip. So it was covered it all from documenting for non-for-profit to summiting Kilimanjaro to Rwanda gorillas. And so yeah, it's good. So we'll have a gallery debut coming up pretty soon.
Wow,
yeah,
that's pretty incredible, man.
Yeah, it was a good trip.
Did you always loved traveling or wanted to travel when you're younger, but did you have a passion for photography back then?
So that didn't really start till I came back from I went and lived with some buddies in Illinois to play soccer. They'd come down here in the summertime, so like, hey, you gotta play soccer, and I'm going up there and making the varsity team for Champaign-Urbana, and then came back, and then basically the school didn't have, they tried to give me a lot of electives. So, cause I'd already pretty much capped out on my classes, and my mom was frustrated about it. So she was like hippie activist and, kind of attitude. So she found out that I could do an independent study through the art department. So, and I knew the photojournalist really well. So, we had a Canon AE-1 camera, and that's kind of where my love for photography started to begin. So I would do independent studies at Camp Creek, developing film and kitchen sinks and shooting sport events with them. And that's when it all started. So
really, back when you had to soak it in.
Hands on, man. Yeah. You roll it in the canister and do your bath and wash and hope that the negatives don't stick on each other. And
wow.
That's cool. Yeah. Very transitional time frame, because digital was starting to come out.
Yeah.
He had a digital negative feed. And I was unheard of.
Yeah.
So it was pretty cool.
It's cutting edge.
Yeah. To get started that time frame.
What do you think made you get into photography? What was it that clicked with you in photography?
Photography, so I didn't really learn till later about myself that I graduated high school and then started traveling like independently, and took photos, humanitarian shots, just like Mexico. And but I think really where I've loved photography is it's never ending challenge, and I'm always learning. Mm-hmm. So, and that's kind of addicting, you know, for myself. So I think deep down I'm a lifelong learner. So photography, I've always been able to, there's always different things you can learn about photography. So I think that's what kind of the hook is for me. And still, you know,
still is.
And the, you know, different levels of it, different kind of angles, but like different challenges and different cameras and different techniques. And
yeah,
you know, so there's a lot of growth possibilities with it. So.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
There's some people that I've met that can understand technical aspects of stuff, mm-hmm. Especially around development and computers, and which now kind of bleeds over into photography. But like, there's other people that just have this natural gift and ability, like an eye, where they can see something in a way. Do you feel like you have both? Like you have that technical side of it that.
Yeah, I mean, technicalities come in like naturally, like you're going to learn the technical part of it. So I've taught classes and workshops and taught here locally at a school before. And one thing I would try to teach the students is just composition. So, because when you add the technicalities and stuff, you can lose the creativity really fast, especially in video. As you guys know in here, there's so many technical aspects to it, from audio feed to, you know, lighting to angles and composition. So, yeah, technicalities can really kind of take away from the creativity, I think. So,
yeah. So
the question with the students is like, can it be taught or is it learned? You know, and I think it can be both, but I think learning it's much harder. I think where you have a natural, like you can naturally, you know, it's like interior designing, or there's like a feng shui kind of thing to it. So I think you can naturally have it. But yeah, definitely can be learned, just like kind of any skill set. But.
Yeah.
Like at your photography shop, you have some like incredible photos. I can look at it and think, wow, that's a really cool photo. But I would never be able to take that photo or like have the eye to catch something like that. I feel like you really do. And has that been, were you doing that when you first start off, that people were telling you, man, you have something different here?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, from the beginning, I think that's kind of, and I'm not a painter or artist or anything that's like kind of standard. So I've never considered myself like an artist, but I think having being able to get past the technicalities. I remember one time my sister's like, she's like, it's gotta be crazy. Your camera's just like an extension of your hand. You know, so it's no, and I thought, you know, I don't have to think about the technicalities of it. In fact, I'm actually tricking the camera to do what I want it to do now, not going off the language it's kind of trying to pitch to me.
Yeah.
So, and I think it really gets in any profession, like you get where you're professional at it and they're like, okay, how can I tweak it? I know the language better than the rules, you know, so I can apply my own recipe to it. So, and that's just time. I mean, I think you put your time in to anything. So, and that's what I've taught in classes before, is like photography is a language, you know, the more I know a foreign language, the more I can speak slang with it. And I can joke with the locals and not worry about, you know, the pronouns and everything. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
When was it, there's the side of actually the artist side of it, but then actually doing it as a business. Mm-hmm. Do you remember the first time like you sold a photo or a,
yeah, I do. I'm like kind of chilly right now. I did a cold plunge, a deep one today. So it's
nice.
Got me right before. Yeah. So one of the first pieces that I sold, I think was really the first time I knew that I could be a professional photographer. Like I felt it was probably when I was in Peru. So we were surfing in Peru, and there's a shot that I've printed for years now. It's called Humble Hands of a Gentleman Holding a Pineapple. And there's a whole backstory to it, you know, but when I took the shot, like I felt like I could really do this. I could do this as a career. Like I felt it like right then. So, yeah, so that was kind of a key moment, I think, as far as doing his business. And then, you know, the business is 90% of the time and shooting maybe be 10, you know? Yeah. So, but,
how old were you then?
I mean, I was already selling, well, I guess 2009. So it's 2009. I mean, I started photography, doing photography because, you know, 2006, let's see. So I was already getting paid randomly, like back in film, to do like family photos and real estate stuff. And then 2006, we had, my wife and I found out we're having twin boys. She had a great job with St. Joe. We had started a property management company. I had like four long-term rentals. And, you know, we all know what happened in 2006 to 2008, right? So great time to start a business. great time to have twins. So we had bought our new house. So, you know, I'm looking down the pipeline and I'm like, I've even the good money I was making with property management, I'm like, it's not going to last. Yeah,
it's not going to
I never want to do photography on a personal note because it's very personal. Like everything, you know, landscape is, I enjoyed the peacefulness of it. Or the challenge of it, but not on a sell. Like I didn't want to open up to opinions. And then I had to kind of get past that point. So started slapping flyers on pizza boxes with Jeff and Bruno's I worked with in high school and started, you know, to make money. So that's really why I started the photography aspect of it. And then it just grew and grew and grew.
Yeah.
So.
Is that a necessity?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 So, yeah. I got to where it was like financial needs and I got to where I'm like, okay, well I can kind of set that aside and start doing other stuff. But yeah, that's kind of how the main reason I started, you know, was to make
it sounds like revenue. That was like a big leap for you in a way. I mean, cause I can sort of understand too, where, like you said, photography was your personal thing. Like your time mm-hmm. to like, this is me time. I get to go work on myself and the things I like doing. And then, yeah, I do know what that feels like. It's like, all right, you're good at this. Now turn it into a business. And you sort of loses some of that, I don't know what to call it, shine, I guess, as far as it being your own thing, mm-hmm. right? Now you're sharing it with the world. Then you have to end up inviting everybody into your world with the, like you said, the critiques, the comments.
Yeah, yep.
But learning to get through that is like taking those critiques on and being like, okay, maybe I can apply some of these. And also learning to ignore some of the ones that don't make any sense at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Were you starting off doing just like wedding photography?
Oh God, no, it's just a portrait. I know. I mean, it's right there in line, really anything I could make revenue on. Yeah. And that also kind of led me into like, okay, what I really like to do. But yeah, I did the math one time. I was doing like 60 plus family photos between May to October,
you know, just the
plus like 650 to 60 hours a week in property management.
Oh man.
Yeah, the glory days.
Dang, that's a grind.
It was a grind.
Yeah. Family twins. Photos are no joke.
Yeah, twins. Yeah, yeah. So, but at the same time, I was realizing that it was kind of a creative outlet. So, you know, Jeff and Tom with Yola Board, they came on board, came on the scene like 2008. I started doing photography like that in 2006. And we hit it off as far as helping each other out. So I was creating collateral for them. You know, I was the first one. I've had my underwater housing since like 97, 98, like the little film ones to like my big boy that I invested into. So I started working with them a lot and, which just grew and grew, you know, portfolio. So, that kind of led me down like, okay, more and more and more until I could leave property management, in 2014. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Just hustle, hustle, hustle.
That's it. Yeah. Hustle. Yeah.
Dude, I think there's people that have like a romantic view of entrepreneurship that, you know, I'm just going to create stuff or it's just going to come to fruition or like overnight something. Even in tech, there's a lot of people that think, oh, just create this app and then overnight you're going to be, you know, multimillionaire. Truth is far from it. even with the biggest tech companies, it was hustle, hustle, hustle for years. Yeah. And sometimes you have to – you have to do the things you don't necessarily want to do or not – in line with the big vision just to get by. And then in order to get to the big vision, you got to find time within the week to work on that.
Yeah. Yeah. There's an article coming out, on me in April with Amarcos magazine. And, the interview, the girl asked, like, hey, what would you recommend to upcoming artists? Said, keep your day job. Yeah, that's good. Keep your day job. And then, you know, that way your finances are covered and you can focus on being creative, because if not, the other way around, it gets stressful fast, you know. But but yeah, entrepreneurship is you know, it's a love hate for sure in every way, but I wouldn't have it any other way, I don't think.
So. Yeah. So you started that in 2006. Mm-hmm. And then by 2014, had you already started Modus?
Yeah, so I signed a lease space in Grayton. I had my first couple employees already. They were like assistants and editing and stuff. So by 2014, I was selling artwork at ArtsQuest, and I was doing really well, which it was an eye-opener for me, like 2009, kind of going back to the original question of the shot in Peru.
Yeah.
It's like 2009 time frame. So then it turned into an art show at ArtsQuest, a cultural arts association, always been really supportive. And one of the ladies there, Jennifer, she had pushed me to say, you know, like, hey, I've seen your photos. You should sell them at ArtsQuest. Whether it be a pitch or like a personal note, they've always been very, very supportive. And then it turned into like one of the first art shows. I remember being on our living room floor on printing, like pasting paper on the back of frames, you know, like literally gluing this stuff to present an ArtsQuest, to only realize that, you know, photo paper and humidity in the frame outside doesn't do good. So the show went good. I won a big art award. But so there's, you know, growth in anything. But yeah, so it was like 2009 time frame. And then ArtsQuest kept on kind of growing from there, and then growing into different mediums, and taking on my own printer, and you know, throwing tools at 2 a.m. in the garage at the printer. yeah, it was definitely a point of difference and separation as far as you know, what I was doing.
Yeah. So. And did you travel at all during that time?
Yeah. Yeah. So my wife has been very supportive and very amazing. So 2009, I think it was, Peru, Nicaragua, we started going like every year. I think it was 2011. Uh-huh. So, yeah, I mean, any little nugget I could get. I went to Costa Rica with Jeff and those guys. And it was mainly, wasn't travel for commercial work yet, though. It was travel for more like surf driven. So Latin America mainly. So Costa Rica, Nicaragua, Peru. Peru is a big, like a 2.5 week trip or something. But my brother was down there for like 6 months backpacking, and I brought reinforcements. Wax, wetsuits, and surfboards. So, yeah, so I was traveling that time frame. So.
Yeah. Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah.
And then after you got going in 2014 with just photography business, and, mm-hmm. and like from there, was that easier? Was that harder? Was it a mixture of both?
I mean, it was definitely a leap, you know, talking about like kind of taking leaps of faith and everything.
Yeah.
I just had a great income with property management. My life sucked on the back end of things, you know, like really bad, and regretfully so, because of like 9 years or 8 years of my kids' life, like not being able to be involved with them as much as I would like to be. So the transition, it was definitely harder in some ways. But then again, I found, like, I remember being gone from property management, and like 3 months later, I'm like, oh my God, like there I am. I'm actually this happy human being that loves life a little bit. So it was easier on a personal level as far as like high blood pressure. but on the business end of it, you know, I have the mindset of like I can figure it out, like anything I get involved in. Yeah. So it was also a ton of growth too, because I was picking up clients for like expedition groups. So I started traveling a ton with the one local client that was putting me all over the globe to create content. So it was, you know, it was figuring it out kind of while I'm going along, but I would say not necessarily easier, but because it's my own dime.
Yeah.
And I think that's a big difference too. When you're talking about entrepreneurship, when you have employees or coworkers that think they understand or really invested, but really they won't understand until they have their own money. Mm-hmm. And it's their own money that they're risking, their own money. Yeah. So it's a big difference of doing that. So,
yeah. There's a whole, it is a whole different mindset. Mm-hmm. You probably relate to that some, of like finding yourself again, like, oh my gosh, there I am, just from like deployments, and then going, man, I've missed all this time with the kids.
Yeah. I think a lot of men find themselves in that position. I mean, it's, you know, I think we're all raised as, you know, as a, your job as a man is to protect and provide. So you're like, I'm going to go out and do what I can to make money for the family. And a lot of the times that's being gone, mm-hmm. Which is just the, you know, side effect of, you know, being successful or actually being able to provide for your family. But yeah, I mean, eventually that time will end, or you want it to end so you can be home with your family. And I think a lot of guys go through that. Not, I think women too as well. But I've seen it on more of the men's side. Yeah. They end up coming back to the family after, you know, doing all their traveling and making money for the family. And then they're like, okay, I want to be home now. And that is always a tough transition, doing that. Because you're settling back into an ecosystem that is yours, but it really isn't. It's mm-hmm. the wives and the kids, and they're like, this is what we do when you're not here. And you have to sort of fit yourself into that mold, and also be the father, you know?
Yeah.
It's a tough road.
But you have more of an extreme version of that because of being deployed and then training when you're deployed.
Being in the military, yeah. I mean, you're pretty much, that is your life. You're gone all the time and then constantly coming back and trying to re-engage with the family, but then only to know, like, in 2 weeks I'm gone again, right? So that's, you're constantly in that pattern of life where I'm not here, I'm here, but I'm not here. And even when you are home, you're not there. You're thinking, like, I got to leave in about a week or two, right? It's, you're never fully 100% committed at home until you retire, and then you're like, oh shit, I'm home for good. And you have to figure out how to incorporate yourself into the family and make yourself useful, I guess, like, because at that point, if you've been gone for so long, the wife and kids have been, they have their own routine pattern down without you. They're like, we've been doing fine without you, and now you have to come back in and find your place. And yeah, I mean, it's a good thing, though. I mean, I think it's something that, like I said, most men and women that work end up going through, and it can be a blessing because you sort of get to start over again.
I think of the story you told me the other day where you were like, you get done with your workout in the morning or whatever, you come home, and Andrea's there working, the kids are off, and you just, like, are walking around pacing the house for, like, 45 minutes.
Yeah, pretty much chewing the carpet. Andrew's like, go do something. Yeah,
she's like, what are you doing?
Chewing the carpet.
Yeah. Yeah. But I do think of, and probably, it's probably more extreme in your case, Eddie, that you, like, find yourself again, like, oh, my gosh, this is what I enjoy doing or this is what I like doing. I mean, you've done the teams for years that you're, like, I don't even know what I enjoy besides being deployed.
Well, it's, and I, you know, I can, it's common with, you know, what you were doing. It's, I was doing something that I enjoyed. I liked being a SEAL. I liked deploying and doing all that. And that's all I knew. But when you come back, yeah, you have to sort of, you don't really have to reinvent yourself. You just have to, like, for me, I was like, what skills can I take from my past 20 years and start doing something here, because I do like it. I have a passion for it. And you just have to make it work and find ways that you can incorporate the skills that you've learned over time. And I'm same with photography. And yeah. Like, okay, now that I'm home, how can I, you know, provide for my family by using some of these skills and still be home every night for dinner? So,
well, and I've been fortunate on being able to grow my portfolio kind of backwards, because typically the commercial photographer is going to be in LA, Atlanta, Miami, and you're doing independent jobs and showing up on creative director, you know, to shoots with big commercial clients. And then same thing, it's a week shoot, it's great money, but really you're prepping, you know, 2 weeks or, yep, you know, from pre-production meetings to, and then you go same thing, like all over and over, and there's these highs of like full focus for a week and then off and then kind of rebuilding. So I've been fortunate. I've actually had, like, you know, 20% of my portfolio is probably commercial, like big commercial, opposed to being able to, you know, where normally it's 80% and then maybe you're retiring and doing landscape gallery and then being at home on the back. And so I've been fortunate on, you know, being unorthodox in that.
That's because commercial pays the money, right? Like,
it's typically really good money, because you have per diems, everything's paid, you know, and then that's leads to other jobs and everything. So yeah, but that's a normal kind of recipe.
Makes sense, because commercial guys, they'll come in, they'll have, you know, probably a director of some sort, and then they'll have teams underneath, and then once you've done really well in that position of
in theory, yeah, I mean, in theory you have, you know, you can go do a job and that agency or that creative team is going to hire you on for the next shoot. But that's kind of lost because now you have the value of digital images may not go as far. So the agency is now being brought into like, you know, straight out of college marketing groups and that don't really have real life experience. So they're hiring their friends or people. So it's really kind of can be difficult on that.
I'm sure.
So, you know, and then that's and it's not just with on the commercial end of it. It's with local, really any budgeted photo shoot can that play into. So
kind of lost the loyalty.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you have a generation where you have experience where you can put a photographer in and they can know exactly how to do everything. To a person that's going to come in and base it off of a social media algorithm that's saying, hey, like this, like this, like this. But, you know, so just kind of, you know, it's just a weird kind of space. And I'm fortunate that I don't have to go kind of dig my heels in deep into.
Yeah, I was actually wondering that. I was going to ask, like, since you were doing this since 2006, right? How did when social media came on, especially now, how has that, like, changed the game?
Well, it's interesting because I have a really good friend. He's he was NYPD Investigation Unit, and, I mean, he's done everything, but a really good friend of mine that's now, he's done social media, gotten the ambassadorships, all this kind of stuff, and he's just a great, great, great individual, creative. And so I've done, a live podcast with him, and one of the questions was that a ton of new creatives, like, they just look for social media for – like, that's how they make money. And which is interesting to me. That's the first time I had thought about, like, that is the avenue for it.
Yeah.
And where my mindset was never, like, that's how I'm going to make money, because it wasn't even relevant.
Yeah, it wasn't an option.
Give some credit to MySpace back then.
Yeah, MySpace.
Tom.
Yeah. So I'd never really considered, like, that's the thought process of up-and-coming, creatives. And so... So for me personally, it hasn't really. I know where I haven't taken advantage of social media, just because I haven't. I'm not a salesy guy, you know. I'm the same person I was back then, not wanting to go into business for photography.
Yeah,
you know, that's, and I've stayed true to that individually, because that's more important than marketing myself to be a social butterfly.
Do you feel like it waters down the actual art of it?
Yeah, I think the struggle really is the. You know, for other artists or up and coming, is like, where do you look for inspiration when that's such mainstream you're supposed to?
Yeah.
And really the algorithms are what are going to, it's not helping you being inspired at all. It's what your own interests are going to recirculate. And so I think it can be really hard to find, to grow creatively, you know, without basing it off of everything's been shot, everything's been created. It's just, how do you want to duplicate it? Where before, I think the mindset wasn't like, oh, well, it's been created before. I'm going to pull some comparables and I'm going to shoot to that comparable. It's more of like, how am I going to want to shoot this?
Yeah.
And so I think you lose growth that way, or at least for me, like if I, like Africa, for instance, they're sending Kilimanjaro pictures. I'm like, I'm not referencing anything. I don't want to. I don't want to have a preset expectation of what I should be getting. And so I want to shoot my own. And so it allows me, one, I think it's less stressful, to be honest, because then I'm trying to formulate these compositions that I can't even get to, or they may not even come up, but I want that image in mind. So I'd rather be frustrated with my own kind of shots that I want to create, you know, if I don't get them or get them.
Do you think, like, that gives you, to me, like, if you're not, like, if you're doing it your way and you're like, yeah, I'm not going to go that route, it opens you up for more creativity too,
yeah,
right?
It does, because
you're not looking at other people's work and then being like, well, and like you said, I feel like that's not just in photography, just in pretty much everything now, right? Especially when it comes to social media, it's everybody's just copying off one another.
Yeah.
There's no originality anymore. It's like, oh, I'm going to do what this person's doing. Yep. I'm just going to do it better. Really, it's just the same stuff, right? So I can see, I'm not partaking in that. I'm going to do my own thing. It just leads to more creativity and being your own person.
Well, and I think it's kind of, why are you in it for? You know, like if I wanted to, I mean, there's a beauty part of talking about like entrepreneurship and like, you know, anybody can make money so easily if they want it through social media. It just depends on how, like, you know, I just got to learn how to market myself. And there's recipes to market myself. Doesn't mean I have to be good at anything other than marketing myself. And so it's pretty interesting because you don't have to be good at, you don't have to be good at any skill set. You can literally be a life coach and know how to market yourself on social media or pay a team to have the money to pay to make money. And, you know, your recipe really is, when it comes down to it, isn't worth anything other than the facade of what the client's going to pay for it. So
keyword is facade.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah. So it's frustrating in some ways, but in other ways, I'm like, I'm glad I haven't been able to do that because I just I'm just not that person, you know? So, but it's pretty amazing in some ways, but completely deflating in others, yes. You know?
Yeah. And I feel like, and you know, I know we're gone on this tangent about social media, but it's like that with any industry. I mean, like I work obviously with in weapons and guns and training and everything. And, you know, I put on courses here locally and I'm almost of the same mindset. I was like, I don't want to sit there and like, oh, you got to market yourself and how are you going to stand out from everybody else when marketing your shooting courses and this and that. And I look, you know, and yeah, you look at other people that are doing it and I'm like, dude, this is all the same. It's all the same stuff. There's nothing different the way everybody else is teaching, right? You can only teach so much about weapons handling and this and that because it's the same basic fundamentals, but it's the way that people market themselves when they do it, like how cool they look when they're doing it or, mm-hmm. you know, what they're wearing. And to me, I'm like, dude, that, it waters it down to where it's like, bro, there's nothing complicated going on here. We're teaching the same basic fundamentals and then you're shooting.
Yeah.
But, and I can imagine it's the same in every other industry as well. And yeah. Everybody is just copying off one another.
Yeah. Well, and that, you know, on when you are actually shooting, and it's just, it's no different than other client relations. You know, the work can be, I mean, there's so many amazing photographers and creatives, but it doesn't mean they can deliver a good experience.
Yes.
And the experience in any business, I think, goes, you know, can get you 85% of the way. Even though you may not be the best photographer, having the experience, being able to communicate and mm-hmm. even work on and out the difficulties on the back end or whatever that may be. You know, which is, who knows if that skill set is within the same grouping of the marketing, whatever. But, yeah, so I'm very glad that I'm not growing up now trying to develop a photography business. And
tough.
Yeah, it's a difference of, like, wanting to open up a brick and mortar and see and smell the ink and feel the paper to it's just everything drop ship.
Yeah.
Kind of mindset. So, yeah. Anyways.
But I think Tim, like when you've proven yourself, you've proven yourself over 20 years, a lot of times what people are paying for, right, is again, the experience.
Mm-hmm.
I see it both ways too, because what's nice is like, hey, you can be incredible at your craft. You're incredible at your craft, right? Like now what you're going to teach me, like when I go out there with you and shoot, like a lot of people could probably teach me, right? Because yeah. I'm basic, don't have very many shooting classes. So like what Eddie's teaching me, he, you know, he's just like, okay, come out, you know.
Well, you have to be a good teacher, right?
Yeah.
That's the other thing in our industry. Like, yes, you have guys that can go out there and shoot all day long and like they're awesome at it. But then you like, okay, show them how to do it. And they can't do it.
Yeah.
Even though they're probably some of the best pistol shots around, you do have to have that craft of being able to teach and knowing what clients that you have and like how they absorb information. So you have to think about all of that, like the first day you're with them and just being like, okay, this person can absorb information when I talk to them like this, or when I demonstrate things like this. But then you might have a different client, like they're not picking up anything unless I am more aggressive with them. And then they're like, oh, okay. Like now I got it. So there is that, right? You have to.
Teaching definitely is a skill.
It is.
Of its own.
Yeah.
For sure.
And you have to be, you have to have like sort of a passion for teaching too. Like mm-hmm. I like seeing people learn, right? I don't, and I think there's probably people out there putting on courses that really don't give a shit. They're just like, shoot, and I'm getting paid, right? Where you have other people that are like, no, I want to actually see people improve as I'm teaching here.
Yeah. One of my favorite thoughts is like when we did like in some point we'll launch it when I find the right piece of land out here. But we're going to do a jiu-jitsu retreat out here, a high-end jiu-jitsu, and bring in top-level guys, right? And same type concept. Like, you can learn jiu-jitsu, especially at lower levels. You can learn from just about anyone. But having top-level guys, it's just kind of that experience coming in.
Sure.
And we would do shooting. So I brought some guys out to the range. We shot, and one of the guys brought his son, who I think was 16 at the time.
Yeah.
And he never shot a pistol before, right? And I think he had shot a rifle before, but he never shot a pistol before. And Eddie, you know, hands-on, pretty much, you know, had to be there right with him because he's not going to just be like, good luck, here's a pistol.
They're nervous, yeah.
He was nervous. And Eddie's, you know, we got some footage of Eddie sitting there and just patiently going with him and encouraging him. Yeah. And Eddie had the biggest smile on his face. Yeah, he loved it. But, like, seeing this kid, and then, but his dad was, like, almost in tears because his dad is going, man, to give your son to have, you know, one of the top Navy SEALs be able to teach your son how to shoot a gun. You'd never say that, but no. But to have him teach your son how to shoot a gun, like, that's special for me. So, for him, he would have probably paid so much more to do that just because of that experience, you know?
Yeah. And teaching. I mean, I share that with, you know, with teaching, like that's how, I was with the travel company I was doing a lot of work with. They brought up, an opportunity for me to work with Orange County High School of Arts out of LA. Mm-hmm. So it was a film department. So what these students do, they're typically like junior seniors and they would normal high school, it's private. But they have to submit a film to even get accepted into the film division of it. So the film division is like every day after school is 3 hours a day. And, but they presented an opportunity for me to teach a class, a workshop to them in Alaska. It was like 14 students over 2 weeks. And because they had a knowledge, I mean, these kids, they're in studio like every day. So I asked the professor, I'm like, I'm not sure what I can bring to the table. Like these students technically, like they know more than I do.
Yeah.
And, but he's like, Chandler, we need your like run and gun real street style so they can learn. And so being able to work with the students that had somewhat knowledge of it when I was teaching, I'm like, God, I love this. It's really rewarding.
It is.
And that's when I'm like, man, I could do this. Like, so teaching just to be able to have that's very, very cool. Whether I'm a good teacher or not, that's yet to be determined. But
are your kids into photography?
Nope.
No. How old are they?
No. I have twin boys. They're 16 and 12-year-old boy. So the twins are heavily into pole vaulting and track. It's like their life. Okay. And then the youngest is he's into basketball. So
none of them have shown any like interest in or like
not really. The youngest did for a minute. He has like my old Nikon cameras or whatever, but no, not really. No, not really at all.
Yeah.
So
that's not that's probably not uncommon either. I mean, it's that's what your dad does for a living, and it's like
I mean, it's just
it's the same thing with me with the shooting and all that. Like I take my kids to go shoot, but you know, I think half the time they're like, "All right, we got it. This is what you do."
Okay. Well, I mean, their age too. I mean, I look at myself, same thing. I'm like, I was in sports and surfing. Yeah. You know, that was it. So,
did they enjoy surfing?
Yeah, they're at the beach. Yeah, and as much as they can. So, like surf lightly. They're not like competitive. There's fun foam tops, and whenever there's a little bit of a swell, they're trying to body surf or
that's awesome.
Whatever. So, but now they're at age now. It's like we're trying to plan out summers where they can actually start. You know, whether it be Nicaragua or, you know, wherever they kind of go out. So it's cool.
Your trip to Africa that you just took.
Yeah.
You hiked Kilimanjaro.
I did. Yeah. Yep. So
I have no context.
How long?
For that.
How long does that take?
So I'm not a mountain man by any measure. So I'd rather be underwater than up on elevation. So Jim Sumner, he's a local gentleman here. He and his wife Christy, they started a non-for-profit called Kids of Kilimanjaro. So the whole reason going, the couple of reasons, selfish reasons, and you know, I'm comfortable with non-for-profits and living and wherever. But the not-for-profit benefits kids' education. So you have porters, which are pretty much like Sherpas that carry gear up Kilimanjaro. So each pack is like 40 pounds a piece they carry on their heads when they're walking. I mean, so they get 10 bucks a day is what normal pay is.
Jeez.
So
yeah.
The government and Arusha and Tanzania, they require for the kids to go to school, you have to pay $400 per student or per kid. And so, you know, there's no way for these guys to get ahead. So, and it's not a private school. Like, that's just to have, you know, uniforms or whatever. So the not-for-profit, so they just created it. So my role and goal was to create content for this not-for-profit. Mm-hmm. So documenting the porters, which were also parents of the kids. So the trek we did was 9 days. So it's so I showed up like 5 or 6 days early to help create content. And then the rest of the team arrived in a 9-day summit. So 9 days is the most successful for acclimation.
Yeah.
You know, where you can get acclimated. So
how high is it?
19. So there, you have three different summits, 19.3 and then 18.8. So, no oxygen or anything. You're just, so 19,000. It's like this, the tallest standalone mountain, and it's one of the seven peaks. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you just hike to a certain point each day, camp out.
Yeah, so we had like kind of, every day was a little different, you know, different distances and height elevation. So we'd go up and come back down, you know, to help acclimate.
Yep.
So, but it was painful because it was raining like literally 8 of the 9 days.
Oh, jeez.
So apparently they've had more rain this year than they've had. The guide who's with us, who's part of the non-for-profit team, it was his 511th summit. Dang, he said he's never experienced rain like that.
Probably like, oh, sweet.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah. But, I wasn't able to create as much content as I wanted, but I definitely have plenty, helped him. So that's coming up in May. But, yeah, so 9-day summit. I was getting in shape for it and running and get my fat ass moving and, you know, weight belt or weight vest or whatever. And
yeah, because you're hauling all that camera equipment as well.
Right? Yeah, so I had my camera equipment, and then I actually have my own separate porter. She was a straight-up badass. I mean, unbelievable. Like, unbelievable. So she had my camera, my rest of my camera gear. So, mm-hmm. So I had my day pack, and then she had my other camera gear. But, it was good.
That's awesome.
Yeah, when you go, I just went to Telluride, and we were at 10,000 feet. And where we're coming from, pretty much zero, right?
Yeah.
And so, I fly there one day, and then that whole first day was like, okay, you can't pretty much do anything. Don't work out. Don't, take it easy. And then they had oxygen machines that you'd basically just sit there for 20 minutes and breathe in. And, like, still you feel kind of woozy a little bit. Like, did you have any acclimation?
I didn't. It was good, one, that I showed up early because I didn't realize, like, the transition, because I think Arusha is you're already at like 4,000 feet.
Okay.
And then I was there for 5 days or something, and then the starting base, I think you're at 7,000 feet before you begin your first ascent to the next base camp. So I didn't have any really experiences that I know of until I got to like summit day. And it's kind of funny because there's a video that I took, like a selfie, and I was like slurring my speech. And I was perfectly fine. So I didn't have any of those experiences until like the actual, like the tail end of the summit day. But I also had my water pack was frozen. So I had a insulated bottle, but the actual tube froze.
Yep.
So I wasn't getting any hydration like 2 hours prior. So, and, you know, in retrospect, I'm looking at like all these things of why I'm degrading. And that's being one of them, you know, so I didn't have any hydration, but, and it was my own fault. We knew it, but I didn't think it was going to be freezing, you know? So,
yeah.
So that last before summer. So, then I remember commenting to the girl behind me. So I was bringing up the tail end because I'm like kind of all over taking photos and astronomy stuff. And so we started the summit at like midnight, and we summit at sunrise. So I made a comment. I'm like, God, I should, you know, like write down all the places that I've taken my camera. And when I said that, I started like, I broke down in tears. I'm like, what the hell is wrong with me? And so that's when I'm like, I'm not connected to these tears at all. Like something is like setting in.
Yeah.
So that's when I kind of first recognized. I'm like, oh God, I, you know, yeah. something's going on. But
a big part of it is just hydrating, right?
Hydration, yeah. But afterwards, you know, talking with Jim, and I think he's gone like 5 times or something. Altitude sickness just affects, and I think there are 3 people that had to come down the mountain before summit, and 1 on the way up. It's just, it really can affect you like in so many ways.
Yep.
You know, and then you can't prepare for it. So, but hydration is big. I mean, you know, from vitamin supplements to hydration packs to oxygenizing your water to like, you know, your vitamins are attacked, vitamin B and D. And so you're like supplementing like crazy town. So,
do you guys have any Viagra?
No Viagra.
That's what help.
Yep.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. So yeah, they give, cause we did a bunch of high altitude training when I was on the teams and I was a medic, and yeah, you carry Viagra with you. So if somebody starts experiencing high altitude sickness or high altitude pulmonary edema, mm-hmm. you pop a Viagra, have them pop a Viagra, and it'll bring them back down.
Yeah, because really the only way is coming back down.
Yeah.
I mean, so, but yeah, there's all those techniques for it. I'm like, God, I had no idea what I was signing up for. You know, I'm like, my whole day pack is full of vitamin offsets and water, so.
Should have just had some Viagra.
I know. Now I know next time.
I'll bring you up, but then back down.
Yeah. Literally.
Yeah.
Did you ever experience that, Eddie? Like, did you ever have, as a medic?
No, I've never had, like, high altitude. I mean, we always did a good job acclimatizing, and then I think predominantly most of the guys are in really good shape, you know? But I did see there were some of the older SEALs a couple times, yeah, I had to like go back down halfway up and because they were getting sick and headaches. But that's also predominantly because they probably stayed up drinking the night before and partying and, you know, not doing what they're supposed to. So, yeah, I mean, like he was saying, everything is a factor when you're climbing to a high altitude like that. You have to be, you know, your nutrition, your hydration, just your mindset, how you are physically, all that stuff comes into play. And you might not think it, but the mountain will let you know about halfway, be like, guess what? You know, you're not prepared for the rest of it.
We had a bug go through the camp. Like, I thought it was food poisoning. I was the first one to get it. It's like, I think it was a 6th night, maybe. It wasn't good for anybody. So, you know, diarrhea and throwing up and everything. And that next day was just brutal. Because we still had to go to the next camp.
Yeah.
And
your bodies.
Yeah, I think it was like a 4-hour hike or something. It pouring down rain. And, I got into camp that night. And I've never been, like, mentally broken like that. But I was also knew that I was really fatigued. So I'm, like, journaling. And, like, I'm done. I'm okay if I'm done.
Yeah.
I'm, like, I'm making any decisions until I wake up. So, so I was able to sleep and woke up. And I woke up and I was ready to go. So it was, like, sleep deprivation.
Yeah.
Like really was an eye opener to me on how I like literally writing down my thoughts when I'm sleep deprived to like waking up and be like, what the hell was I thinking?
You know? It's because your brain was in overdrive. Yeah,
just completely. Yeah. I mean, I was toast. I didn't go to sleep like 3 a.m. or something and up at 6:30.
And that's probably had something to do with, you know, when you said you summited, you broke into tears. That's probably like your body being like, holy shit, we did it.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It's just like that release of like everything that you had just gone through.
Yeah.
So it's naturally coming out.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's I don't know if I want that again. I don't know if my wife, she, you know, when I got down the mountain or whatever, she's like, would you ever do it again? I'm like, hell no, I would not do that again. But then we went on a safari, and then I'm like, if I had to do that again for this, I mean, I had a great experience with this big bull elephant coming up, like literally right next to our car is a private concession safari. And after that, I'm like, yep, for sure. If I had to do that again just for that experience, I would do it.
Yeah. I mean, those experiences, especially when you're pushed to your limit, right? Mm-hmm. Like you are that you're journaling and you're like, dude, I'm done. Like I'm fine if I don't keep going. But then you pushed yourself to keep going. Those experiences level you up in ways that you just don't you can't comprehend at the time. And like you do get done with those and you're like, oh, that's last time I'm doing something like that. But I think it takes some time to process. And after a while, your brain and your body's like, dude, let's do more.
Well, that's right? Why, like, you know, that's what's crazy, because I never understood why. I mean, I understand adrenaline, right? I mean, I understand surfing and wanting bigger and better and like you're dropping in and then you want, like, I really, if I would have grown up in Hawaii and had a training ground, I think I would comfortably be a big wave surfer. But I can understand that growth. But I never understood it when it came to like climbing or doing that. And I understand that now. Like, what, you just want more. You know, yeah. You want to like push yourself again. And even getting in shape for it, even beforehand.
All the preparation.
The preparation, the mindset of going into it. And that was really like, retrospect, looking back, I'm like, and it parallels photography or any career or whatever, but really the mental push was great.
Yeah.
I'm like, I've never wanted to do an Ironman or any of that kind of stuff. I'm like, okay, I can probably do like almost like the half marathon. I'm like, I think I could probably do it, you know?
Did you do it?
No, I didn't do it, but I didn't sign up for it. I got back in late, and then, cause I was getting where I was running like 3, 5, 7, 9 miles. I'm like, okay, where are my breakpoints, and, you know, kind of pushing it. But
is it primarily physically, you say level up physically, or is it more mentally?
Mental, yeah. Mentally, I think mental, and then your physically is just going to naturally follow.
Physically, you're broken down, right? It's you've pushed your body to its physical limit, and now it's on your brain, the mental state to like overcome that. And that's where you do level up, I believe. I mean, I did that, you know, that big race, a 200 miler in November. And yeah, there was a point in that where I was prepared physically beforehand. I mean, I trained my butt off for it. I was running 20 miles a morning, you know, with a weight vest and doing all this stuff. But it doesn't, like, at a certain point, your body is going to be like, this, we can't go anymore. Like, we are in ultimate pain. And you can either make that decision there, like, okay, I'm going to listen to my body, or you can push past it. And there is that little switch that can go off in your brain where, as soon as you push past it and keep going past that pain, your body sort of goes, your mind goes into overdrive, and it's like you realize that your body is so much more capable than you know of, and it's all just up here, you know, in your mind. And I learned that going through, I mean, everybody learns that going through SEAL training. That's the point. It's like, you can do more than what's expected of you. It's just on you. Are you mentally strong enough? And that's where people end up quitting in SEAL training. It's not because they're not physically prepared. It's they're not mentally prepared. It's because they will drive you, just like climbing that mountain or doing a ultra or doing something that's going to physically push you beyond your limits. Your mental state can either stop you or propel you forward. And it's those people that can push past that pain and have that, you know, that little switch flip in their brain, like, I'm going to keep going. It's like during hell week, you're up for the whole week. I think you get about 3 hours of sleep. And I was an instructor for a year and a half, and I would watch these students, and you see it like Wednesday. If they make it past Wednesday, you could literally tell those people, like, run through that brick wall, and they're going to go do it. Like, and they'll just keep their robots because their brain has now taken over, and they're like, I can do anything. And it's to their own detriment a lot of the time, which is why, I mean, Hell Week is designed, that 3.5 hours of sleep is there on purpose, because anything less than that, you die. Like, you need that 3.5 hours, and they are constantly feeding you and giving you like everything you need, because they push you so much that, yeah, you could possibly die doing it. But they also want to see who is going to mentally do this, who is going to, like, you know, have that switch flipped and be like, I can push past this. And then who are the people that are too mentally weak?
Do you think that the mental game is environmental, or is it genetic?
I think it's a mixture of both. I think it depends on, yeah, like, where people come from. And it's like a whole different topic, but like a lot of the guys that make it through SEAL training, they've found out now we all come from some sort of traumatic backgrounds, right? Yeah. We've had to struggle in some form or fashion to get to that point where we're at. So there is a lot of that. It's a lot of, I'm going to prove the world wrong type mindset. I mean, and that we've talked about this before, you know, we have D1 athletes, we've had NHL, NFL players quit. They show up and they're the ones that quit. It's because, and it, you know, we talked about, they've been pampered, you know, they're gifted, they're talented. They've been told their whole life how gifted and talented they are. And they show up to that training and it's like, guess what? You're nothing. You are just like everybody else. And you actually are just a piece of shit, just like everybody else. And we'll see. And usually it's the people, it's the kids that, it's like a 130-pound kid who has been struggling his whole life to make the team or, like, told he's not good enough. Those are the ones that are able to push past everything because they've already been told that their whole life. Like, you're not good enough and you're not going to make
kinda
it.
I kind of love that. Yeah. You just want, you're like, yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's an awesome thing. But, you know, you also have the gifted people making it through as well. Like, it's not like they all don't make it, but you just see people, and like to answer your question,
sense, you know, just there's more grit, more fight.
It is genetic, and there's some environmental stuff.
Would you say that no one, in a sense, everyone that comes there, they haven't been pushed that far before? Like, they all have to.
Nobody, I don't care if you've done, I don't know how many ultras or whatever before Hell Week, there's nothing like it. Like, and I can say that just because I've actually gone through it and I've been an instructor watching people go through it. And I've been through other selection courses in the military and nothing compares to that week. It's by far, it's why Navy SEAL training is considered the hardest training out of all the branches. Everything else around that, every other branch does. But Hell Week is its own entity that will push people to their brink and see if they're able to push past that.
When you look at that, do you think that's super healthy so that when they're in the teams and they hit some, that there are scenarios that come up that if they hadn't gone through Hell Week, they wouldn't have known that they could push themselves to that limit? Or?
Yeah, I think that's what you take from it. I mean, it's just like you level up, just like we talked about going up that mountain, right? You now know, like, I can push myself past what I think I'm capable of. Other people think that I'm capable of, like, I've done it before, so it sort of has this like, you're not scared of anything effect. You're like, you know, hey, we're gonna go do this operation and we have to summit two mountains, do this like within 8 hours, and you'll never, I mean, some guys would be like, oh shit, but you'll never hear people say, oh, we can't do that. Mm-hmm. It's like, all right, let's go, let's do it, you know. Oh. Because they've already pushed themselves, you know, past that point before, so that they don't have that lack of self-confidence. Whereas if somebody, you take just some normal person, it's like, hey, we're going to go do this. The first thing they're going to say, I can't do that. You know what I mean? It's the same premise when I was signed up for that race, and I would tell people like, yeah, I'm going to do this race, and like, oh my gosh, I would never do that. And you're like, well, that because of that mindset right there. Like, you can do it. You just have to go do it. Yeah. And push yourself. And I mean, I think that's why it's a beautiful thing, like doing stuff, you know, like summiting Kilimanjaro. It's an awesome, not only is an awesome experience, but you are bettering yourself in a way that there's no drugs, there's no prescriptions that can make you get to that level. It's, you're doing it on your own.
Something's really interesting about the Kilimanjaro summit, especially with the team they were with. You know, our African team's 40 people, from setting up tents, breaking down tents, cooking breakfast, lunch, dinner, breakfast and dinner. And these people, if you ever get to go, you know, we all experience humanity on like a poverty level or a different country. These guys were, I've never experienced humanity like that before, ever. And just cheerful, no judgmental among themselves. I mean, it's just pure, like pure, pure, pure. And
it's raw.
Yeah. And I mean,
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, like, for instance, like, I was doing an interview with one of the guides, and I asked him to, I'm like, sing me a song just to get vocal, you know, just to get some audio, kind of make sure we're dialed in. And he didn't just sing me a song. He got up and started dancing and singing a song. Like, there's no, like, you know, he wasn't ashamed, or he wasn't, you know, he was just being himself.
No insecurity.
And it doesn't matter if the supermodels were out in front of us or the president, it would be the same. So there was just this connection of, like, just human connection.
Yeah.
You know, that's just really, really pure. So, and they treated you like that. But it wasn't like a matter of treating. It was just like, that's who they are.
Yeah, this is how we live. And
yeah, I mean, literally have these porters. They're not decked out in gear. They're like bare tennis shoes. You know, they don't have electrolyte packets. They don't, I mean, they're just doing it, you know, to make money for their kids.
Yeah, and, it's a whole different lifestyle that America couldn't even comprehend.
Yeah.
I mean, because I remember thinking the same things when I'd be over in Afghanistan. I remember one op, I was like on a mountaintop. We were overseeing this village, getting ready to hit a target the next morning, but we were watching it, and it was December, I think, and we're up there in like puff gear. You know, I have like four different warming layers on. It was freezing, and I'm looking down. I'm watching this woman take her children out in the morning, bare feet, just barely any clothes on, go into the river. They're just like bathing in this ice cold river like it's nothing. And, you know, they're happy. They're not, you know, complaining. That's their lifestyle. And you're like, dude, they like, you're almost jealous.
Yeah.
You're like,
yeah, man, the simplicity of it.
I wish, you know, not that I wish, but I was like, it'd be so awesome to have that simplistic mindset mm-hmm. to where, yeah, they don't worry about anything else but survival.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's almost like there's a inverse relationship between like lots of money and comfort and
yeah, there
happiness.
Always is. Yeah. 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 And this was, like I was saying, I've experienced that in Mexico and Costa Rica and like poverty, or not poverty, but third world countries. But the lack of, I mean, their own lack of prejudices against each, even amongst each other, you know, like they were. It wasn't like they were just there to serve. They were there to have a good time, and like we're summoning them out, and they're like singing songs. And so it was really like spiritual. It was just an uplift. And then you take the 8 rainy days, and I think if they took that equation away, like the uplifting of who we're with, I think, you know, more of the team would have just kind of easily faded off.
Yeah.
You know, just because it was like you get to camp, and they're like singing a song and encouraging you and stuff. So it was pretty impressive.
That is awesome.
Impressive stuff.
It's almost like they're serving y'all.
Yeah. I mean. Yeah, happily, just there, encouraging, uplifting, and everything. So
you said you like to be underwater more than climbing mountains.
Yeah, that's how I've grown up.
Do you do photo stuff underwater?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yep.
You do any, like, great white dives or anything like
that? I haven't done great white dives. I've done, like, whale sharks. We went off the Yucatan. You know, we have them in the Florida Gulf Current, the whale sharks. So, and I missed an opportunity, like, back in the day, when I just got my first water house, it was like 2008 or 2009. We have them really close on the beach. I didn't get any photos. We went out a mile out, paddled a mile out, swam with them. But my photos were horrible. So about 3 or 4 summers ago, I'm like, screw it. I'm going to Mexico, paid a private charter, brought me out 20 miles and swam with them and got photos. Why? Other than just redemption for myself. But
it's awesome though.
Yeah. So underwater. Yeah. Do underwater, like free diving, scuba. You know, the thing with photography though, once you get under like 30 to 40 feet, your lighting just done. So, you know, that's where I'm not the technical diver that's going to have all the lights and get the macro shot of the seahorse on the reef. I'm just not that. I'm not that guy.
Yeah.
So, but snorkeling, free diving, you know, I don't say convenient, but where I can still enjoy it and have flippers in the camera housing with me and, you know, go out. So
yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. A lot of my work, actually, I have a lot of underwater photography and video and stuff. So
that's awesome.
Yeah.
How far down have you been before?
I mean, diving wise, I'd stick 90 feet and up. So free diving, you know, like 60, 65.
Wow.
But even then, you're, you know, 65 feet's pretty deep as far as, like, lighting goes. So, you know, 40 feet's kind of a sweet spot. And even then, there's a lot of surf shots, you know, surf level kind of shots and different housings to accommodate it. But you know, you go to Hawaii and you don't need to go that deep. You know, you're 30 feet and you're seeing plenty of everything.
Yeah.
You know, and even then, it's black volcanic kind of stuff, so. 30 feet's plenty to be at, to hang out. So.
How long can you hold your breath if you free dive in
there? I think my static, like, breath holds, like, 3 minutes. So static. So normally if you're doing, you know, 3 minutes, if, you know, you're doubling your time. So you're prepping for 3 minutes. Or if you're, you know, if you're basically prepping for 4 minutes, you have a 2-minute bottom hold. Wow. So yeah, but you get, like, deep breathing, diaphragm breathing, stuff like that. Anybody can...
anybody can do it. It's just practice.
Yeah, it is practice and making sure you're with the right person that can help you out if you black out.
Yeah.
So which will happen. Yeah.
Which you've experienced a lot.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. A couple of times I've blacked out. Yeah.
Oh, you have?
Yeah. I mean, that on my own stupid decisions.
Yeah. I look in retrospect now, I'm like, God, we used to snorkel all the time and spearfish. And it's amazing we didn't die.
Yeah.
You know, and same thing, it's like 30 or 40 feet, but blackouts happen, you know, 15 feet.
It's also the deeper you go, the easier it is to hold your breath and like, but it can also be dangerous because then you can feel real comfortable down there.
Yeah.
And you're not accounting for the time I still have to get back up to the surface, especially if you're down 60 to 80 feet. So, yeah, I mean, that's where it gets dangerous.
Yeah.
So you can get super complacent.
Yeah, I think, what is it, but like below 40, you don't, I think below 40, you don't come back up. Below 40, you sink.
Yeah.
You don't float anymore.
Oh, really?
But.
It isn't there like, like level, like timetables? Like
for diving, yeah. Yeah, you, I'm going to mess it up.
Yeah, it's like 30 feet, I think 60 feet and 90 feet or something.
So, you got to like stay at that level for a little bit.
Mm-hmm. It kind of depends on what your gas, like what you're mixing to, if you have nitrous and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and if you do like a free ascent coming up, if you were on any type of gas or anything like that, then you're coming up and you're blowing out the whole time, right? Because then you don't want to get a arterial gas embolism.
Yeah.
Have you seen guys get that?
I think a couple guys had got it. I mean, we dive all the time but we're using different rigs. We're using the non-rebreathers. So that can get...
chemical cocktail.
Yes, the caustic cocktail, which that can get nasty.
That just takes away the bubbles, so you have rebreathers. So typically when you're diving, the bubbles are going to scare off, like, really any, not predators, but, you know, they don't like it. So, but rebreathers, you have a mix. So I've never done it. I don't want to do it.
Yeah, I mean, it sucks. They take the fun out of everything, but it's, you're using a rebreather. And like you said, it's this chemical called Sodazorb. So it's what you're breathing in goes through that, cleans it, and then comes back up and you're just a constant, circulation. And, if you go down too deep, stay down too deep too long, if you get water in there, there's all these factors that you can get a caustic cocktail. And then once you get one, I've never gotten one, but I've had dive buddies that have, and it's like it's your whole throat and everything is just burning because all that chemical has gotten in there. So you automatically have to come to the surface and wash their mouth out and then take them to the hospital. But yeah, I mean, you can get an arterial gas embolism at 3 feet of depth.
Really?
Yeah, it's possible.
Wow. So y'all use rebreathers so that if you're sneaking up on the target or whatever.
Yeah, no so bubbles. We go hit ships. We'll either plant limpet mines on ships or actually do a ship attack where we'll swim underneath the ship. Everybody's on there on the line. It's like a whole procedure of
crazy.
It is. It's nuts. We're all like using hand signals under there, but eventually you come to the surface and hook the ladder and everyone starts climbing up onto the ship. But that's the reason we use the non-rebreathers, because you can't tell that we're under there, hopefully.
Mm. That's pretty wild. Y'all have to do that in training no matter what, right?
Yeah. I mean, we have a three-week block each time, two- to three-week block where we practice it. I mean, I've never done an actual dive real world. I mean, Afghanistan, Iraq,
crazy. There's
no diving over there. But that's part of our job, part of our job. So we practiced it each time.
Yeah.
I think one time we were going to get tasked. An IED blew off a bridge and a bunch of people fell into the river in Iraq and vehicles. And they were trying to task us with like going in there and recovering the dead bodies and everything like that. But I mean, the current was ridiculous. And we were like, no, we're good on that. Like, it's.
That's wild. Do you have any buddies that have done missions like that?
No. There's not a lot of diving in the past 20 years. I'm not discounting. Well, actually, SDV teams, SEAL Delivery Vehicle, they're in Hawaii. They are a national asset. So they do a lot. I mean, those guys do nothing but dive. So they're in a SEAL delivery vehicle that's underwater. So they, I had buddies that went there and they spend up to like 16, 18 hours underwater.
Jeez.
In freezing cold water. And it's, I mean, if you can imagine that long, no talking, no nothing. You're just focused on doing whatever task you're given. But buddies that I've talked to that have been over there, they're just like, yeah, dude, it's miserable.
But they level up, yeah.
I'm sure
that's the next task. That's for the hope,
right? Yeah,
you can keep that level.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, dude, thank you for coming out, sharing your experience, and
hey, thanks for the invite.
Where's your shop located at?
So I have a gallery, in Creighton Beach. So this is the 11th year of the gallery. And then I opened up a new men's store last year. So it's just hit the year mark, Valentine's Day. So that's based off my images, putting them on apparel. And there's
it's a Brotique.
Okay. It is a Brotique. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah,
so is that in the Creighton as well?
Yeah, right there in the complex. Yeah, totally unexpected. But yeah, it's been a lot of fun. So
I'm going to come check that out.
Yeah, we have Damascus Steel Knives.
You would like it. They have like Tupac shirts and all sorts of. Oh,
yeah, we sick. Cut up like 50 vintage stuff and sew it and print it and, you know, do custom one offs. And it's good.
And then you have a workshop out of here. You have a warehouse.
Yeah, my studio, Route 393 North or South, sorry. So it's a shooting studio. So full like product, models, talent. I also rent it out. So it's 38studiorental.com.
Do you do stuff for like content around here? Like, has people hired you to come out and do like,
I have,
video shoots?
I have. I'm just really specific on making sure that, one, I have interest on doing it. Two, that there's an actual budget. More so that like that I have interest in shooting it, and it's something that I want to shoot, or there's like my style of shooting.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I'm going to shoot product stuff. I shoot product stuff. Actually, I just, I don't know if Mick showed you the pictures of the guns or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I shot that in the studio.
Did you?
So
they look great.
Yeah, it was just like a random. I'm like, God, I have a little bit of time. And it was fun. It was like, 40 minutes of stuff. But so I'll shoot product stuff. And I've actually gotten so my commercial part, I'll do more architectural stuff. And then like not real estate, but like higher end. I'll spend a day. If it's a luxury house here or like hotels, like boutique hotels. But,
okay.
But yeah, studio is great. It's simple. It's kind of a happy place. And we'll have the Africa event May 15th there. Okay. So to help, it'll Africa photos or my photos from Africa also have kind of the announcement of the Kids of Kilimanjaro kind of deal.
If people wanted to be involved or help out, would you shoot them to the nonprofit
to
donate there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and I'm kind of helping them on the back end too, like putting together a website, kind of their like basically the kind of marketing touch points for them. So it's a great, it's an unbelievable non for profit. So it's a really, really good cause. But
awesome.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll leave a link down below for that then.
Okay.
Awesome. Thank you, man.
Yeah, thank you guys very much.
Appreciate it.
Yeah.
Really great.
Yeah.
All right. Out.